You're listening to Policy Currents, a weekly podcast from RAND. I'm Evan Banks.
And I'm Deanna Lee. Every Friday, we bring you new insights from RAND's latest research and commentary. It's October 25th.
On Wednesday, U.S. officials confirmed that North Korean troops were deployed to Russia to support the Kremlin's war in Ukraine. According to RAND's Bruce Bennett, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is likely exchanging troops for more advanced military technologies from Russia. If these troops suffer heavy casualties abroad, then that could lead to instability for Kim's regime at home. Such volatility would also pose a risk to South Korean security. This dramatic news is the latest of many recent developments to signal growing ties between Pyongyang and Moscow. So what should we make of this warming relationship? Earlier this month, Bennett wrote at length about Russia-North Korea relations. He said this partnership is more likely a marriage of convenience, or a marriage of desperation, than a long-term alliance. Russia appears to have pursued the relationship because it was desperate to meet needs for its invasion of Ukraine. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is desperate for food and other resources. And both Kim and Russian President Vladimir Putin worry that if they fail, then they may not hold on to power at home. This common thread underscores their desperation. One way the United States could undermine cooperation between Russia and North Korea, Bennett wrote, is to conduct major information operations. For example, media stories could tell the Russian people that North Korea has sent dilapidated artillery and other munitions that have been causing Russian casualties. Efforts such as these could fuel distrust and eventually help speed the demise of a dangerous but potentially fragile partnership.
Last week, Israel Defense Forces killed Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in Gaza. What does the death of one of the terrorist group's most consequential figures mean for the future of the Israel-Hamas war? It won't bring an immediate stop to the fighting in Gaza, says RAND's Raphael Cohen, but it will impact the war, as well as the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict more broadly, in a few profound ways. To start, Sinwar's death may remove a major obstacle to releasing the remaining Israeli hostages held by Hamas. Whether Sinwar's absence will actually unstick stalled negotiations remains to be seen. But the death of a leader is historically one of the catalysts for ending seemingly intractable conflicts. Second, Sinwar's death changes the structure of Hamas, potentially creating a power vacuum within the group and damaging its organizational backbone. Hamas has effectively been reduced from a, quote, cohesive paramilitary organization with the size and capabilities of some smaller European militaries to a loosely affiliated, decentralized guerrilla group operating in the shadows for its own survival. This will impact how the war in Gaza is fought, increasing the chances of a more atomized, less coherent conflict going forward. In other words, the conflict might transform into a series of local battles and locally negotiated ceasefires. Third, Sinwar's death closes what Cohen calls the first act of the Israel-Hamas war, and sets up what comes next. Without Hamas as its most recognizable villain, Israel will continue to shift its focus toward Hezbollah and Iran. This, more than anything else, Cohen says, shows why Sinwar's death matters. Quote, the Israel-Hamas conflict is not just a war against a militant group or another iteration of the broader Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It has become a proxy for a host of other competing geopolitical forces shaping the Middle East and, indeed, the globe.
Between 2017 and 2024, U.S. economic policies toward China have focused on promoting fair trade and defending U.S. interests. A new RAND report explores this period of heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing. The authors assess policies, including the effectiveness of U.S. tariffs, restrictions on investment and exports, supply chain diversification, and efforts to boost domestic manufacturing. Overall, they find that these policies have had mixed results. For instance, U.S. tariffs have succeeded in reducing imports and the bilateral trade deficit with China. Washington has also had some success in reducing China's access to sensitive U.S. technologies through lawful means. However, U.S. policies have largely failed at ensuring fairer treatment for American firms in China and at persuading Beijing to stop its unfair trade practices. It's also important to note that America's approach has not been without costs. Some policies, particularly tariff increases, have come at a price, such as reduced U.S. economic growth and losses in U.S. manufacturing jobs, output, and exports. There are several ways the U.S. could advance its goals regarding China. For example, Washington could maintain higher tariffs on select Chinese imports, while offering to reduce certain U.S. tariffs in exchange for reductions of Chinese tariffs on U.S. exports. It could also consider ending subsidies to companies in sectors that are not vital for U.S. national security and in which Chinese firms have a clear advantage. U.S. leaders could also signal that Chinese foreign direct investments that do not threaten national security are welcome.
Abortion care in Virginia is legal and accessible compared with the landscape in many surrounding states. But like 35 other states, Virginia mandates that minors seeking an abortion involve their parents, guardians, or other adult family members. Virginia also requires that the minor notify a parent, guardian, or adult family member of their decision 24 hours in advance and obtain a written statement of consent, which must be notarized. Evidence from a recent RAND study suggests that such regulations may have burdensome implications for providers and patients. For example, Virginia law allows public notaries to refuse service for any reason, despite guidelines discouraging refusals based on personal beliefs or biases. And not all minors have parents or guardians who will provide consent for an abortion. As a result, some minors may even fear disclosing that they are pregnant. Notably, there is a process known as judicial bypass, which allows the minor to appear before a judge to seek authorization to act without a parent's consent. But judicial bypass comes with its own complications. Minors must demonstrate to the court that it's in their best interest to not notify a parent, and that they are mature enough to have an abortion. Not all judges fully understand the statute guiding this process, and lawyers may be reticent to pick up these cases. According to Julia Rollison, lead author of the RAND study, all this is in stark contrast to legal protections for minors seeking pregnancy care. In Virginia, and many other states, laws specifically give minors the right to receive prenatal care as well as labor and delivery care without notifying a parent. In fact, Virginia's code specifically notes that minors, quote, shall be deemed an adult to consent to their own care and the care for the delivery of a child. What Virginia has now is a legal paradox, Rollison says. Minors are granted agency to direct their own medical care when they choose to stay pregnant, but not when they want an abortion.
That's it for this week's episode. If you'd like to learn more about what we discussed today, check out the show notes at rand.org/podcast. RAND is a nonprofit institution that helps improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis.